This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
The beginning of the war is really, really complicated, and in many senses, it's sort of a war that happens by accident.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
The Soviet-Afghan War lasted 10 years between 1979 and 1989 and led to the deaths of between 500,000 and 2 million Afghan civilians. I speak with Nick Gearing, who's a Russian history and language teacher. From his memories of the haunting sight of uniformed amputees in St. Petersburg to the complex origins of the conflict, we explore the intricacies of a war that was both an accident and a tragedy. Our conversation traverses the murky politics that led to the invasion, the unpreparedness of the conscript heavy Soviet army, and the brutal reality of life for soldiers caught in the mountainous terrain of Afghanistan. We also discuss the question of international support for the Mujahideen and the impact of Western-supplied weaponry. The episode also shines a light on the deeply entrenched hierarchy within the Soviet military, harrowing drug abuse amongst the troops, and the chilling treatment of prisoners of war on both sides. As we approach the Soviet withdrawal, we reflect on the war's enduring scars and how the conflict is remembered today in Russia. I'm delighted to welcome Nick Gearing to our Cold War conversation.
After finishing secondary school, I applied to university to study Russian. So I had to go off to Russia to learn language for a year before I went off to university. And that was in 1998. So it was only 10-ish years after the end of the Soviet-Afghan War, so 98 to 99. And this was, of course, post-Soviet time, although there were still lots of hangovers from the Soviet Union. Your customs form still got stamped with a hammer and sickle on the top, all of those sorts of things. A lot of people carrying around passports still that had SSSR on them. But one of the things that you notice, that I used to notice quite a lot, was certainly in the middle of St. Petersburg, where I was, outside the Gostiny Dvor metro station, there were a number of double, triple, quadruple amputees sitting in their wheelchairs begging. And they were still in their uniforms. And that was really my first exposure to this as a subject. I'd seen it on the news. I'd heard a bit about it. I'd heard, this is the USSR's Vietnam, all that kind of stuff. But that was really the time I thought, this is actually an event that affected real people and did real damage. There were people my age or a little bit older than me who had served in the Chechen wars. And so there was always the comparison between them and veterans of Afghanistan as well. So that was really the first exposure that I had to veterans of the Afghan war. Then things really took a bit of a back burner. I had more interest, I think, in the contemporary events that were taking place in Russia. I also had a possibly slightly excessive interest in Tsarist times. But when I got a job at a school just outside North London about 7 or 8 years ago, I was employed there for the first time to teach Russian. So we had the A-level Russian syllabus to teach. And the fall of the USSR is really the dominant cultural topic for the second year of the course. And one of the boys that I was with wanted to talk about Afghanistan. So that started me off, having to read up a bit on the subject, find some source material, break it down into areas that he could talk about for his speaking test. Because as you can imagine, it's a massive, massive topic. And you couldn't possibly do it justice in a 10-minute exam. And then we had 2019 come along, which was the anniversary, the 30th anniversary of the withdrawal of the Soviets from Afghanistan. And I was invited to do an assembly on that topic. And that was an amazing experience, because I know a lot of people think that when teachers do assemblies, we just go up there and waffle. But there was a huge amount of research that I had to do to condense it down to something that I thought was meaningful. So yeah, that's really where it all went.
What was the, you know, the background to the invasion? Why did the Soviet Union feel that they needed to invade Afghanistan?
Well, it depends who you ask. If you ask Jimmy Carter, he will famously say that the Soviet Union just waltzed on in, you know, into the unaligned nation of Afghanistan. If you ask the people writing Soviet newspapers, they'll talk about it. They like to talk about international dog, our international obligation. Brezhnev, for as long as he was still able to string a sentence together, would talk about his own doctrine. But it seems pretty complicated. The beginning of the war is really, really complicated. And in many senses, it's sort of a war that happens by accident. So you have the coup that takes place in 1978, which brings the sort of socialist government into power. And as far as we can tell, and from anything that I've read, and I've had a look at minutes of the Politburo meetings and accounts of people who were around at the time, as far as I can tell, there is no appetite in the Soviet Union for a coup in Afghanistan. They just think, you know, it's too economically undeveloped. It's too tribal. It's not the kind of place that we really want to be waltzing on into. It's not the sort of place where we can't help these guys out. And so clearly the communist leaning peoples in Afghanistan, in Kabul, are likely to be interested in getting help from the Soviet Union. They don't really seem to be that keen on doing that. But the coup takes place, and then the Soviets are sort of stuck with it. And they deal with things in quite sort of stereotypically Soviet kind of ways. You know, what do you normally do if you're imagining the way that the Soviets would intervene in someone else's conflict? Well, we're talking about assassinations, probably, aren't we? Yes, that's what we have. You know, we have, so you have President Tariki gets murdered by his successor, President Amin. And the Soviets, at this stage, they think, you know, what are we going to do? We have to support this new government. They've got lots of advisors on the ground in Afghanistan anyway. They've had a fairly long-standing sort of economic cooperation with the country. They're quite invested in Afghanistan in a number of ways. And so they have to support this new regime. But Amin is a bit of a loose cannon. He starts doing all sorts of things. You think, well, this is sort of the 101 of how you get yourself a civil war started, you know, picking fights with senior tribal leaders and this sort of thing. So the Soviets deal with him in a very Soviet way. They have Storm 333. They power on into the palace and gun Amin down. And it seems that up until the moment they break in, Amin is pretty sure the Soviets are there to protect him. And then in they come and they install his successor, and this, it goes from bad to worse.
And how much popular support was there for the communists
in Afghanistan? You would think, wouldn't you, that before going in, the Soviets would find that out, but they don't seem to know. And certainly the people that go in, sort of the first-hand accounts that I've looked at, they don't know anything about what's going on in Afghanistan at all. They're just really not familiar with the way the country works or what people think. So honestly, I don't know. But you might well have a stark contrast between Kabul, which in the late 70s looks very much like a southern Soviet city would. Much of it seems to have been built by Soviet engineers. And the other areas of Afghanistan that are much less well-developed. Those areas, I can imagine, there's very, very little appetite for the communist government. I always get the impression with the people outside of Kabul that so long as you left them alone and let them get on with life as they normally did it, and, you know, just didn't really force stuff down their throat, you were probably going to be okay. Well, that might be a relative term, but you know what I mean. But Amin doesn't do that. He really tries to get to grips with these people in a very aggressive way, and that ends extremely badly for him.
So the Soviets go in, kill the previous president.
Yep. And in fact, so as part of the sort of prelude to all of this, it's not that the Soviets have no troops on the ground before this happens. So Tariki and Amin have been quite keen on getting some Soviet support in to bolster their own positions. And there's this very, very, very strange idea that comes up that, you know, there are lots of peoples in Afghanistan and that there are Turkmens there and there are Turkmens in the Soviet Union. So how about we just dress up some Soviet Turkmen soldiers in Afghan uniforms? And who would know that you were propping us up? That this seems to be what they really want to do. That the Soviets send, I think, there are something like 24 helicopters. I can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, they send them some helicopters. Then they have to have some pilots to train them to use the helicopters. And yeah, so that they slowly get pulled into it. And that does look a lot like what happens to the Americans in Vietnam. They don't really keep a lid on their involvement. But yes, so Amin get the chop in a very bloody kind of way. And the next man is Kamal. And he's essentially installed by the Soviets. And then the troops roll on in after that. Or in fact, just before that and then on after.
Right. And it sounds like the Afghan army isn't in great shape.
No, that would definitely be fair to say. And any of the veterans who've spoken about the Afghan army are almost overwhelmingly disparaging about it. They'll talk about that. So they do a lot of training. And that's one of the things that it's okay for people in the Soviet Union to know about. So the people on the ground back home, the families and so forth and the general populace, as far as they're concerned, Soviet soldiers aren't being involved in any fighting. They're there to build schools, build hospitals, build bridges, build power plants. They're there to train and support the local defense forces. And it's up to the local defense forces to do their fighting. And that is sort of what the Soviets want to achieve and never do. But yeah, the Afghan National Army just seems to be in a terrible shape. And one of the other things that comes out quite a lot from whenever any of the Mujahideen groups get wind of a Soviet operation or one of these big clearing out exercises that they do, the suspicion always falls on the Afghan National Army as someone tipped them off. You might say, well, of course they're going to blame them. But that does seem to be quite credible. You do hear stories of people switching sides from Afghan National Army to one of the Mujahideen groups and back. And there was one man mentioned in an article published in, I think, Pravda. And it's recently published in Pravda, you know, part of the sort of coverage of the 30th anniversary of the withdrawal. So not mentioned at the time, who apparently had switched sides an astonishing 8 times throughout the war. I don't know how you'd have the gumption to do that, especially with people that didn't really have the greatest record of respecting the human rights of people that fell between their hands. But, you know, hats off to him. He seems to have pulled that off.
You can imagine him going, oh, here he goes again.
Yeah, you can imagine, oh, I recognise you.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. You know, you mentioned the Mujahideen there. What sort of shape were the opposition forces in when the Soviets came in? Were they pretty disorganized at that point?
Shapeless. And there's a book, and we might talk a bit later about books, I don't know. But there's a book that's really, really informative on the Soviet ground war in Afghanistan called The Bear That Went Over the Mountain. It's not the children's book. There's a children's book with the same title. You don't want that one. I mean, maybe you do, but not for the Soviet war. That book talks about the Soviet experience. And the way that these reports are written, the Soviet hierarchy they've got a very much European war, Cold War mindset. You know, it's operational warfare on grand scales with vast sweeping amounts of mechanized infantry and tanks and so forth. That's what they've been brought up to expect, what they've been trained to expect. And along with that comes an organized enemy. And of course, you know, NATO is an organized enemy par excellence. You know, NATO command and control, it's just this amazing, you know, uber brain that controls NATO's forces. And therefore, they must be dealing with an organized enemy. But half of the problem is they're not. There isn't an organized enemy. There's no structure to the Mujahideen groups. And you might think that makes them easy to defeat. But quite the opposite seems to be the case, because they can melt away. And you can't decapitate this beast. It doesn't matter how many people you kill. There are just more, and so on the one hand, yes, the Mujahideen groups are very disorganized. On the other, and never seem to get an overall sort of strategy that of opposition to the Soviet Union. But on the other hand, that seems to be one of the things that makes them very hard to defeat.
Yeah, and you know, when I was researching before this call, you know, despite the Soviets' communist credentials, there appears to be a Maoist group that are fighting the Soviets as well in Afghanistan. I can't imagine it was huge on numbers.
I haven't come across them, but I can imagine that niche was probably a fairly common description for groups in Afghanistan. There must have been some groups that were just tiny, and you know, as one of the things that a colleague of mine said, who was a veteran of British forces in Afghanistan in 2008, said was, you know, one of the problems is identifying your enemy. You see him one day and he's a farmer because he's got a plow in his hand. Next day he's got a Kalashnikov in his hand and he's a Talib. And you know, I suppose there must have been groups that were just, you know, very disgruntled farmers at some point that must have decided they wanted to have a go.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you mentioned Jimmy Carter when we sort of started the conversation. What was the international reaction to this invasion?
The Moscow Olympics were not terribly well attended, were they? And that's pretty swift after the event for a large number of groups to pull out of the Moscow Games. Yeah, the international community doesn't like the Soviet intervention at all.
Soon does sort of like the West start to contact the Mujahideen and try and empower them to give the Soviets a bloody nose?
The CIA get in there pretty quickly. One of the best sources of information on what's going on the ground comes from the CIA's reports on what they see. So things like the drug abuse, for example, everything that I found that has any kind of tangible figures in it is from the CIA. Yeah, they get on something pretty quickly. They start off with some fairly rudimentary weapons, things like, you know, old bolt action rifles and that sort of thing. And then they take it to a bit more, well, that they start bringing in more serious weaponry soon after that.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's libsynads.com.
Okay, so the Soviets are coming in as though it's a European war with large mechanized forces. So how do they try and, you know, enforce the rule of the government in the rest of the country? I mean, Kabul, they can't stay there all the time. They've got to go out into those outlying areas.
For those of us who, like you or I, have grown up in the UK, we're used to the concept of having a professional army. And for our American listeners, I'm sure that they're used to the idea of a largely professional army with the idea of a draft at certain points. But the Soviet army isn't run like that. The Soviet army is made up essentially entirely of conscripts. Only officers will be professionals, and then also praporshchiki, so essentially warrant officers. But warrant officers in the British army, I don't know what it's like in the American army, warrant officers in the British army are very, very well respected, very senior men, very experienced. That was not the case in the Soviet army. We have lots of jokes going around in Russian about warrant officers and about how they're totally useless and all they want to do is line their pockets at the expense of the stores. So what you're dealing with is an entirely conscript army. And you've got your raw material, your recruits. They haven't chosen to be there. So it's not like the Falkland Islands. It's not like the British Army going to the Falklands, where you've got highly motivated, highly trained, highly professional men. It's not like that at all. you've got these people who they haven't chosen to be there. They have to turn up because they turn the right age, and they're in for 2 years. So you've got a very, very limited amount of time to make them useful. So training is really very rudimentary, and it is absolutely focused on a European war, certainly initially. And all of their equipment is set up for going, you know, traipsing on through Germany and you know, giving NATO a bloody nose. It's not set up for mountain warfare at all. I suppose one of the most famous things is about the Soviet footwear. So one of the things that Soviet soldiers wear is long calf length boots made of Kyrza, which is a sort of it's a cheap alternative to leather. It's a sort of plastic impregnated cloth. Horrible stuff. I have a pair of them. They are absolutely dreadful. And the soles, that they're fine for jumping out of the back of your BTR armored personnel carrier, bayoneting a few people who've been, you know, badly injured by artillery, sitting in a trench for a bit, and then jumping back and carrying on. But they are absolutely not right for patrolling mountains and trying to climb up steep slopes in those. It would just cut your feet to pieces, especially because you don't have socks. People talk about the Soviet foot wraps being perfectly good and you know, a cheap alternative to socks. But you have to wrap your feet in a sort of cotton, it's like a cotton tea towel, and you have to start a certain way of folding it to wrap your feet up. And if you don't get it absolutely right, then you start getting really bad blisters. And I can imagine that was one of the things that really cut soldiers' feet apart. So yeah, they're not set up for that at all. What they're set up for is, yes, as I say, jumping out of their personnel carriers and occupying some ground for a bit, and then back in and off they go. The uniforms that they wear are totally unsuited for mountain warfare. They don't have enough magazine pouches, so they can't carry enough ammunition with them. They don't even have proper working rucksacks, which would sound insane to anybody who's served with the British Army, certainly, and I imagine probably the Americans as well. So if we sort of go back to how their uniform works, a uniform jacket, combat jacket, you would imagine would have, you know, a huge number of pockets because you need pockets. But the Obraz 69, so the model 1969 uniform, which is the one that replaced what they wore in the Second World War, brought in 1969, it has only the jacket only has two pockets on the front, and they're not deep pockets. So you can't really put very much in there. You're supposed to put your tourniquet and field dressing in there, but it's pretty useless for that. So they actually end up attaching the tourniquet and field dressing to the butt of their rifle, which then means that the tourniquet degrades and becomes useless. They don't have a good uniform. They have a belt kit, which has on the back your entrenching tool, and you have a water bottle, and then you have two magazine pouches. But that's not enough. Two magazine pouches is just not enough for any kind of firefight. And to carry things on your back, they have. I don't know if you've ever seen them. You must have seen these in Second World War films. It's a single pouch, and it's sort of brought together in a knot by the carry strap at the top. And those are passed over the shoulders. So very, very limited amount that you can carry, not very comfortable, really just not set up for carrying things for any length of time or any amount of stuff. And that's what they go into battle with. And they have to improvise very, very quickly. So even the paratroopers, actually, who have a thing that they call the desantnik, so the paratrooper's rucksack, the 54 pattern paratrooper's rucksack, even that isn't actually a rucksack and has to be modified so that you can actually put it on and use it as a rucksack. They take some of the belty bits off that, and they sort of add a few rifle straps here and there and all that kind of thing, and then they manage to make that into a rucksack, and that is reasonable, but they still have to strap lots of things to the outside of it. For things like magazines, they will take the belt magazine pouches and some rifle straps from their AK-74s, and they will improvise together a chest rig, so you have across your chest as many magazines as you can get your hands on. They'll also take they'll take the magazine pouches from the RT-54 rucksack and make those into a chest rig as well, because that way you can, if you need to, divest yourself of your rucksack and you can still fight. But one of the other things they do, and this would sound completely crazy to anybody who was in a counterinsurgency kind of situation, but they help themselves to chest rigs from the Mujahideen that have been killed. Because those have that they seem to be either Chinese imports or locally made copies of the Chinese chest rigs. They've got enough pouches. They've got enough grenade pouches and enough magazine pouches to make them worth having. So that their equipment is just not up to it. And but one of the lasting positive legacies, I suppose, of the war is that they do bring in a much better, more serviceable uniform, which, although the Russian Federation don't use it anymore, is still in service with a number of post-Soviet states today. The 88 pattern summer and winter uniforms with bellows pockets and six pockets on the jacket and pistol pockets, etc. Very good, well-designed uniform.
Do the Soviets have any success initially, though, in the fact that, you know, this is quite a surprise that they've come in?
So the initial stages I haven't had a huge amount of detail about. So most of the more detailed stuff comes from the sort of slightly later stages of the war. Whenever they organize an operation, and they love to think about operational warfare, even if they go up into the Panjshir Valley, which is where Ahmad Shah Massoud is based, one of the really effective anti-Soviet leaders, they always seem to be capable of winning the fight when the operation is going on. That's okay. The Mujahideen will quite happily, or they'll fight, but they'll give ground and off they go. But the thing that the Soviet Union can't do, or the thing that the Soviet Army can't do, is hold that ground. They do identify important spots throughout the country, and they set up outposts on those, and they'll surround those outposts with minefields, and they'll have VDV paratroopers stationed on there for the duration of their service. But can you imagine being in an area the size of a tennis court for a year with a bunch of other guys and probably no soap? But they really just can't keep hold of the country. And one of the other things that they always talk about is it being a limited contingent. So it's the ограниченный контингент советских войск в Афганистане, the limited contingent of Soviet forces in Afghanistan. And it's about 100,000, so not that limited, but it is fairly limited compared to the rest of the size of the Soviet army. But estimates are that they would need to have five times as many men on the ground to be able to control the country. So no, there's no way which they can really control the ground at all. And even roads that they control during the day are under Mujahideen control at night.
But presumably in the early part of the campaign, that the Mujahideen don't have much of a anti-aircraft capability.
No, they don't. And in the early part of the campaign, although statistics are hard to come by, the Mujahideen death toll seems to be absolutely catastrophic. But they just have enough people, more people who are really irritated by the Soviets being there, that they'll get more of them to come in and fight. Yeah, so their anti-aircraft capability comes in later, and certainly helicopters. If the Soviets didn't have excellent attack helicopters, they would have been really, really embarrassed in Afghanistan. The helicopters worked really, really, really hard. Helicopter pilots flew ridiculous numbers of missions. I can imagine the mental toll on surviving. Well, in fact, I know the mental toll on surviving helicopter pilots was dreadful, because there was a friend of mine who served with the Danish Army. He was a Russian interpreter for the Danish Army, and they were doing a joint exercise in Ukraine in 2001. And so he was attached to a Ukrainian general. He was his interpreter for the duration of the exercise. And they had a helicopter to transport them around the battlefield. You can imagine, you know, it's a battlefield the size of southern England. But, you know, that's just the corner of Ukraine, so that's fine. They're being transported around. And they took him to one side and they said, "Michael, this is your pilot." I can't remember his pilot's name. "This is your pilot. He's our best pilot. And he's our safest pilot. But he is a little weird." So this man, he was with them all the time because he was essentially their taxi driver. He was just so far, but, you know, such a vast distance, you had to be traveling by helicopter. And in the bar or in the restaurant or in the mess, wherever it was that they were, he would never sit anywhere unless he had a wall behind his head. He would never let anyone take any photographs of him. And the most worrying aspect of his behavior was that he insisted on flying no higher than 5 meters above the ground. So if there was a bridge, he would fly under it. If there were power lines, he would fly under them. And the reason given was that if you flew higher than that in Afghanistan, you just got shot down.
Wow. And I presume they're aside from the offensive operations, they're flying a lot of resupply to isolated outposts.
Absolutely, yeah. So we always like to think of the helicopter gunships and their enormous fighting capability. Rightly so. But yes, so the majority of the time that helicopter pilots are out, certainly the majority of missions that any of the veterans on the ground talk about, it's evacuation of casualties and most of all resupply, especially to those outposts, because very often there's no other way of getting up there. They've mined all the other approaches.
And did the Soviets have a view as to how long they thought this campaign was going to last?
It's very interesting that, so there's a major general at the time who sadly died in 2015. Brilliant name. Okay, Major General Kim Makedonovich Tsagolov. Right. Imagine having a dad called Makedon. That's amazing. So he was a senior general at the time, and he was interviewed by a Soviet newspaper, Argumenty i Fakty. And they published this interview, and he was just absolutely scathing about the politicians. And this may well sound familiar to people talking about the Vietnam War as well, that it's not clear what victory would look like. And so therefore, they just don't know how long they're going to be there. And it's very, very unclear. What are we supposed to do? What's the intended outcome? You talk about stabilizing the country, but what does a stable Afghanistan look like? Especially with an Afghan national army that is so unreliable. So yes, they just don't seem to know.
And so do they start changing their tactics, and does that help them in any way?
So they start off with an idea of getting more out into the regions. And then later on, their tactics seem to change, strategy seems to change to protecting population centres. Neither of those is particularly effective in delivering a stable Afghanistan. They do have some success in small unit tactics. So they do manage, for example, that there are some missions in which, and it's usually the VDV, the paratroopers, because they really bear the brunt of the offensive operations, or brunt of the patrolling operations, sorry. So offensive operations, you get more motor rifles involved in that as well. But there are stories where there's a village that's on the top of a rocky escarpment, and the Mujahideen leaders of various different groups have decided to use this for a meeting because they consider it very, very safe. You know, that there's only one approach. It's a bit like Edinburgh. There's only one approach up Princes Street, and they can't, you can't otherwise scale the cliff. But the VDV paratroopers do climb up the cliff and attack the position from behind and wipe out the meeting. And they're amazed. Mujahideen veteran said that up until that point, he didn't really have any time for the Russians, as he called them. But after that, he respected the Soviets. He was actually a veteran of both that war and also the American-led war later. And he was scathing about both sets of enemies. So I don't know quite what we make of that. But he did say that the Russians used to fight us man to man, but the Americans just hide behind their walls and go out in armored vehicles, and he really didn't have any respect for that.
What sort of casualties are the Soviets, getting throughout? Well, at the start, I mean, are there large numbers of body bags going home?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that makes the whole thing totally impossible to cover up. Overall, they suffer about 10,000 dead, so it's about the same rate. I think it's about 20,000, isn't it, who get killed in Vietnam? I think that's about right. And it's about the same rate because Vietnam goes on for about twice as long. So they suffer the same sort of casualty rate as the Americans do in Vietnam. And you can imagine you can't cover that up. You can imagine what that does to your morale as well. And morale is not great in the Soviet army. So yeah, they are suffering some serious casualties, and these boys are going back to the Soviet Union in zinc coffins with a nice window in it so you can see who it is. Great. And being repatriated, and for the first years or so, Brezhnev's time, Andropov's time, Chernenko's time, they're being told that these people, that they died in road accidents, training accidents, work accidents. You think, where's the Soviet Union's health and safety? That how are we having so many accidents? And of course, eventually, it gets to the stage where you just can't cover it up. You're sending people out there for 2 years at a time, or less, of course, because you have to train them a little bit first. And these people are coming home, and you know, are they not going to let on that they've been involved in fighting? Well, they're not all going to keep it quiet, are they? So eventually, it comes out, and certainly with Glasnost, it really comes out in a big way.
And I was going to come on to that. I mean, the original decision, I mean, Andropov was involved in. Chernenko was barely there for a few days, it seems like. So Gorbachev comes to power. What does he do?
So Gorbachev, a lot of people are a bit sceptical, I think. Certainly among the Russian veterans that I've come across are quite sceptical about his legacy. Things that Gorbachev does that I think, you know, really do speak volumes are, first of all, the things like Andrei Sakharov, the dissident scientist. Gorbachev calls him personally and invites him back out of exile in Gorky to Moscow and allows him to speak up against the war. Gorbachev is the one who decides that he wants to end the war. He doesn't want this war to happen at all, and he institutes a plan, or he gets his boffins to draw up a plan to bring the Soviet soldiers back. But the biggest difference, that certainly from what I've seen, is in the press. So Glasnost took a bit of a hit with Chernobyl, which I think is slightly unfair because the Chernobyl disaster happened, you know, months after the policy was announced. You know, how can you imagine it's going to take effect? But if you look at the way the Afghan war is covered in the press, and up until Glasnost comes in, it's you know what Soviet press is usually like. It's turgid. It's all very heavy on political ideology. There's really no content at all. It's if you remember Blackadder Goes Forth and King and Country magazine, it's like that, but the communist version. You know, all the Soviet soldiers have biceps the size of you know, Brest Litovsk. But when Glasnost comes in, the tone that comes through in the press, even if it's the same authors, is it couldn't be any more different. So the interview with Sokolov that I mentioned earlier, that's from 1989, just shortly after the end of the war. I think it's the 18th of February that was published. Have you ever seen the coverage from the withdrawal? So the Vremya program, like essentially the Soviet 9 o'clock news, of the time. Have you ever watched that video?
No.
It's harrowing. So the last time that I saw a news episode, you know, the end of an armed conflict, it was just I've never seen anything that's been quite so emotionally charged. So you can look it up on YouTube, and maybe I can share the link. It's only in Russian. It's not subtitled yet, but it's just a broadcast of the news for that day. So there's a lot of rhetoric and you know, that sort of thing you would expect. But then you have Mikhail Lyshinsky's coverage from on the ground, and he says some things that really hit home. So he said, for example, he says, when will this war won't actually end until these young men we see coming in now no longer have nightmares with the faces of their comrades in them. He says this war is not going to end until the people who took part in it no longer hear shells exploding on the roads and machine guns in their dreams, and are woken at night by crashing helicopters hitting the ground in flames. You know, that's says something about the trauma that these men are going through, because he was embedded with the army for quite a lot of the time. And he also then goes on to say that the war will not be over until the widows and the orphans that it's created are given a clear and concise answer to the question, what were they fighting for? And it's on official Soviet TV.
Wow. The weapons that the West supply towards the end give the Mujahideen some greater effectiveness against the Soviet forces. So I think probably the most familiar one people will be with is the Stinger, which really helps to deter Soviet helicopters from flying too high, by the sounds of it. But what other advanced weaponry, were the Mujahideen provided with?
So yeah, the Stingers are the ones that are best known, and there's a little bit of a myth around the Stingers. That the Stinger, people talk about the weapon that won the war for the Mujahideen. By the time the Stingers came in, I think the first ones are supplied in 1986. by that stage, Gorbachev has already made the decision that he wants to pull out of Afghanistan. So it's not a war-ending weapon in that regard. So high tech doesn't seem to be the thing that makes the Mujahideen effective. The really effective thing, the thing that brings down most Soviet helicopters, are Chinese-made heavy machine guns. So that you just throw as much lead as you possibly can at the helicopters and you knock them out of the sky. And the Mujahideen also develop effective anti-helicopter tactics. They set up helicopter traps. So you induce a helicopter to fly over where your position of your machine guns is, and then you knock it out of the air from there. As we saw with the more recent war in Afghanistan, it's roadsides are also, you know, where you score a lot of hits. Ambushing, and there's lots of footage of this because the Mujahideen love. I suppose one of the pieces of kit that the Mujahideen get that really, really makes a difference for them is video cameras, because they can take photographs and they can shoot film of their combat operations, and there's lots of footage that you can see freely available that shows oil tankers and petrol tankers in flames after they've been ambushed by the Mujahideen. So it's usually with fairly rudimentary weapons, very often Soviet weapons.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information.
Did the Soviets manage to, or the Afghan government, did they manage to infiltrate the Mujahideen to any great extent?
Not that I have ever found out about. Not that I can say. You do. So I was looking for evidence of that kind of thing, and what I actually found out about was that there were a number of Soviets that had defected to the Mujahideen, and so I went down that rabbit hole. There was a man called, I think his first name is Nikolai, his surname is Bystrov. I saw him interviewed on Russian TV after he returned. He was a conscript sent out by his superiors in the hierarchy of conscripts, which we might describe it a little bit later on. Sent out to get some drugs. He's captured by Shah Massoud's people. And amazingly, instead of being horrifically tortured and horrifically killed, he becomes one of his bodyguards, marries a local woman, converts to Islam, and lives a longish life in Afghanistan. And then only after I think about 20 years does he return to the Russian Federation, and is quite happy to be talking about it. Amazing, but not the only one. There are a number of people who seem to have done similar things.
Right, but the normal policy with the Mujahideen would be to kill any Soviet prisoners.
Well, so they said they did hold some prisoners. There was a TV show, a classically action-packed show called Krepus Badabier. So the Fortress of Badabier, Badabier, Badadier. I can't remember exactly how it's written. Which is about a big Soviet prisoner of war camp. And there are some held. There are some who, in spite of what General Gromov says about not leaving a single Soviet soldier or officer behind, there are still some who are in captivity at the end of the war. And there are some who are just missing. No one knows what happened to them. But yes, the standard policy by most Mujahideen groups seems to have been that they're not interested in holding on to these people. They don't really have any exchange value as far as they're concerned. So yes, they'll use them in whatever grisly way they want to make their point.
And if the Soviets capture any Mujahideen, is that sort of treatment reciprocated?
I can only imagine it probably is. Nobody that I have spoken to will admit that they tortured anybody. And I haven't managed to get hold of anybody from the Afghan side. And I don't speak Pashtun, so that would be quite hard to do. But I haven't come across anyone who's willing to do that. However, I have read firsthand accounts of what happened to people who fell into the hands of the federal forces in Chechnya. And that's only a few years later. So I think we can fairly safely say that there was a lot of mistreatment of prisoners that happened on the Soviet side, yeah.
Yeah, seems to be echoed right the way through to today.
That does seem to be the case.
So Afghanistan borders on the Soviet Union. Did the Mujahideen ever carry out any raids across into the Soviet Union?
They seem to concentrate on their caravan routes through to Pakistan. That's not really a big area for them. Certainly not that I'm aware of. But there is quite a lot of action that involves the KGB border forces. So there are a number of them killed, and they are involved in a certain amount of fighting. But the majority of what the Mujahideen try to do is get their supplies in through Pakistan. So that seems to be where most of their effort is concentrated. And there we're talking about caravans of weapons and so forth being carried on the backs of animals. So very, very rudimentary in lots of cases. And, you know, if you're interested and you don't mind subtitles, there's a Russian show made about this called Caravan Hunters. It's got your standard action-packed production values, but it is quite entertaining. And I think it does also glorify the way the Soviets act a little bit. But it's an entertaining show. And it's, what it's actually about is that this group of caravan hunters are then sent out to try to get hold of some stingers to see for what this new weapon is that's been sent home against.
Oh, well, have to send me the link to you.
Yeah. I think it's still on Amazon Prime Video. I'm sure other sources of video footage are available, yeah.
I mean, you spoke about that the Soviet army was very much a conscript army. Now, I've read a lot about, that the conscripts were treated really badly and that there was a lot of bullying.
Yes, that's right.
Going on.
So in Russian, the suffix shina means rule by, essentially, and it's usually used in a negative connotation. So there's a name given for this. You know, if there's a term for it, this is bad news already. So it's called dedovshina, which sort of roughly translates to rule by grandfathers. So you've got, what's all that about? So you've got two intakes a year, spaced roughly 6 months apart. So and you're in for 2 years. So and this only refers to the ground forces, the army. So for the navy, they're in for 3 years, and that's a different thing. And the air force, they're a small number, and that's a totally different thing as well. So it's just for the ground forces and the VDV. You're in for 2 years, and you'll be in, and then 6 months later, the next lot of next intake will come in, and 6 months later, the next one comes in. So you have this sort of six monthly, quarter of your service, sort of unofficial seniority. There's no rank attached to it. There's no extra. There's no pay, no difference, nothing like that. But it's the way this works because that's the tradition within the armed forces. So they actually have slang terms for each of these. So you start off as a duch, a ghost. Then you become slon, an elephant. Then you become chirip, a skull. And finally, you are yet a grandfather. And then when you're demobilized, you're dembel, which is a demobilized man. Those are the happy ones because they go back to civilian life. And the way this works is that the more senior you are on that scale, the more you can get away with. And it's ruled by grandfathers because the most senior recruits will just simply... They'll bully the junior recruits for whatever they want. And I only spoke to people who were willing to talk about this from the experience of the Chechen wars, but the indication was that this was the way things had been done for many, many decades. So when you join the army, you're issued with a new uniform, which is new. Great. And, 2 years later, your uniform's looking a bit shabby. Well, no, it isn't, because what you do is, if you're a grandfather and you want a nice new uniform, you go and find a first-year conscript, beat him up and take his uniform and give him your old one. And those sorts of things. You might also just get bored and decide that you want to go and beat someone up you know, because maybe if they'd had enough video games, they wouldn't do that. But that was one of the ways they entertained themselves. And there was also another pecking order. So the trend seems to be that the better the unit, the less this happened. So although it would occur at some point within the VDV, the paratroopers or the naval infantry, those are good units. Those are combat effective units. They have fairly high morale. They tend to have less of this. In the motor rifles, you have more. In the engineers, you have more. The artillery, you have more. The ones that are really hellish are the ones where the construction battalions, which are full of people that are not considered effective to send into combat at all. And there, you know, that's really, really dreadful. And people will try to feign injuries, bribe doctors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, try to get out of service. But yeah, that's how it works. It's ruled by grandfathers. You also get within a unit another pecking order, that what you are trained to do, your specialism within your unit, will also indicate your sort of level of unofficial seniority. So the scouts are top of the pecking order, and apologies to any radio operators out there, but the signalers are at the bottom. So the scout company might send for a signaler and then just decide to beat him up because, you know, they're bored.
And do you think that continues to today in the Russian army?
I knew you were going to ask that. Not exactly. And the only reason that I say that is that they no longer have 2-year service. So you don't have the same senior conscripts and junior conscripts coexisting. So the environment has been removed. I don't think it's because there's been some great push on soldiers' rights necessarily, although I would be delighted to be proven wrong on that.
I mean, I keep referring back to Vietnam, but there was drug abuse in Vietnam. Was there similar challenges in Afghanistan? I guess there's more easy access to some of these substances.
Yeah, I mean, Afghanistan produces, is it 90% of the world's heroin? It's, yeah, dreadful problems with drug abuse. According to the CIA, so there was a 1986 CIA report that suggests that half of all Soviet soldiers in Afghanistan were using drugs, be that smoking hashish or taking heroin. I don't know if that's true. No one actually really has any definitive figures on that. Some of the Soviet generals did admit in 89 that there were problems, but they said, yes, some. But, you know, some could be anything from 10% to 80%. I don't know how reliable that figure is. 50% gets banded around a lot, but then that's also a round figure. So I don't know, but certainly it was widespread. It was the thing that led to Bistroff being captured. It was the thing that led to a lot of other people being captured, being sent out to get drugs because you had senior conscripts who wanted you to go and get the drugs, and then you got captured. That seems to be a fairly common way of falling into the hands of the Mujahideen. Also, what didn't help was the ban on alcohol. So there was officially no alcohol in Soviet bases, and I'm told that this just meant they would replace that with harder drugs. So you could get hold of drugs in Kabul or in any of the major cities, but the Afghans are very, very enterprising people, and they would quite happily get hold of a bag of drugs and then saunter on up to a checkpoint and then swap them for some weapons, some ammunition, whatever it was that they wanted. So yeah, widespread drug abuse, and that had a lasting effect within the Soviet Union.
Does the war end by some form of negotiation, or is it purely the Soviets just packing and leaving?
No, so the you had the Geneva Accords at the end of 1988. So you have the famous picture of Gorbachev and Reagan shaking hands across the table, and they agree to set up a new Afghanistan, or they agree that they'll work towards a new Afghanistan. You're going to have a president, I think two deputy presidents, a prime minister. It was supposed to have a representation from all the different groups in Afghanistan. And this was going to be your new, wonderful, peaceful country. And the implementation of that part of the plan doesn't ever really seem to have made any impact at all, but the Soviets go ahead with their withdrawal. And so if they pull out on the 15th of February, 89, but they keep sending in military aid until the collapse of the Soviet Union just 2 years later. Yes, so the Geneva Accords are signed, and that really sort of gives the timetable for withdrawal. And so phase one, they pull out a certain amount. In fact, there's, for the beginning of phase one, part of the thing involves actually deploying a whole load more troops to help the first lot come out. And then after that, they pull out bit by bit by bit. But some of the really famous events of the war and ones that have really remained in public consciousness happen even after the first phase of withdrawal. So you may be familiar with Operation Magistral, which is so 1988, which was the one that's featured in the film Ninth Company, although fictionalized in many ways, such as it being a year later and all this kind of stuff. But that's what it's based on, and the battle for Hill 3234. So that's a highly successful operation in many ways, although has no lasting impact at all, it doesn't seem, to reopen the road to Horst. And that works swimmingly, and the roads reopened, the siege lifted, all that kind of thing. But, you know, just months later, the last Soviet soldier leaves.
Yeah, it seems like the Soviets are able to take ground, but then not hold it.
Yeah, I think that's it in a nutshell. That also, from what I've heard of people that have served in the later interventions in Afghanistan, is the same thing for them. So you can take it, but you just can't hold it.
Yeah. Does the communist government teeter on for a few years?
Yes.
What happens to them?
Yeah, so in 86, Karmal is replaced by Najibullah. Najibullah, great moustache. Maybe I'm being unfair to him, but his main policy aim seems to be to stop the Soviets from leaving. Because as far as he can see, he just can't defend his country at all. And he doesn't have armed forces that are up to the job. And not to be too dramatic about it, but without the Soviet army there, he's a dead man. And he's, of course, eventually unsuccessful. He isn't able to stop the Soviets from leaving the country. But they do send him aid. So a lot of the vehicles that were taken to Afghanistan are then handed over to the Afghan army. You know, helicopters, lorries, some fighting vehicles are handed over to the Afghan army, ammunition and so forth, weaponry. And military aid and supplies and food has also been supplied by the Soviet Union. All that aid keeps coming in. And Najibullah's government does manage to hold on for another couple of years. But how long he would have been able to hold on for had the aid still been coming after 1991 is unclear. And to give him his due, he doesn't run away. He doesn't try to put up a palace somewhere in a foreign country. He doesn't do an Idi Amin. He stays to the end and he dies. He's killed at the hand of the Mujahideen.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
How is the Afghan War remembered in the Soviet Union? In Russia now.
Yeah, in Russia now. So I haven't had much to do with any of the veterans outside of what the current Russian Federation. I know of people that I know who know veterans from Belarus, but mostly any of the veterans that I've actually had any dealings with have all been from Russia. It's a very complicated picture. There was a lot of embarrassment in the 90s about the Afghan War. There was a sort of the acceptance that it was largely, so what Sakharov calls pristupnaya vojna, an illegal war, that they shouldn't have been there at all. But with the way things changed politically in Russia, with a rise and of, you know, to give it as neutral a term as you like, a greater sense of national confidence, a greater sense of pride in their armed forces, more, this is pre-2020, certainly pre the invasion of Ukraine, with a greater sense of capability, you know, we saw in Crimea and in 2008 in South Ossetia. There seems to have been more, I wouldn't say necessarily rehabilitation, that there's been a change of emphasis in how the war in Afghanistan has been portrayed. But I think actually the biggest change is that rather than having people in the West point the finger at the USSR and say, you know, you've got everything wrong in Afghanistan. What an embarrassment. You should never have been there in the first place. Well, Western armies then went into Afghanistan and made all the same mistakes as well. And they really didn't feel that bad about how it had panned out. So there's a lot more acceptance of the heroism of the, you know, the sacrifice and that side of, so the personal experience, the sort of macro politics of it. I don't think people are that interested in many ways. I think that the collapse of the Soviet Union is still something that a lot of people are quite embarrassed about, certainly if they were invested in it. But they will often say, and this is what came through in Sigolov's interview, they say it was, the war was lost by the politicians. We did our job.
Are there any war memorials or anything?
Yes,
like that?
There are some. Yeah, there are some. I haven't seen any. So I was in Russia from 1998 to 1999. And 2001, 2002, and I wasn't actually able to do a huge amount of traveling because of the still Soviet-era style visa regime that I was under. But there are some. There aren't as many as you might think, or maybe more than you would imagine. I don't know. But you know, the Soviets do, they do like a good memorial. Every town in Western Russia will have memorials to the Great Patriotic War. There are some memorials to the Soviet-Afghan War. Not that many, but yeah, there are some. And its image has also been rehabilitated largely through popular media. So there's been more coverage of action from Afghanistan in film and TV.
So if I want to learn more about the Soviet-Afghan War, are there any books or films that you can recommend?
Certainly, yeah. So my favourite book on this topic is by Svetlana Alexievich. If you may be familiar with her book on Chernobyl. I don't know if you've come across Chernobyl Prayer. That's also an excellent book.
Yeah.
But her book, Boys in Zinc, or I think the American edition is called Zinky Boys. So it's Zinkovy and Mychiki is the original Russian title of it. I think it's been translated once by a British author, once by an American translator. So what she's done there, and apologies to anybody who's already familiar with the way she works, it's not a book of history. It's not a book of analysis. All she's done is very, very, very much like a Cold War conversation. She's just gone off and she's found as many first-hand accounts of people who are out there as possible. And she's just written them down and with a little bit of her journalistic tweak on it. But that's essentially what she's done. And some of those accounts are incredible. They don't give you a full picture, but they do give you a taste of some of what it was like. And things like people who will go and find people who've got hepatitis A and get hold of some of their urine and drink it so that they don't have to go out on patrol. Or people who, you know, the things that you just wouldn't even think about. So there aren't enough beds in that hospital, so they have to lie on a greatcoat on the floor. That kind of stuff, that comes out really strongly in her book. Then there's a book by Roderick Braithwaite, who is a British historian, called Afghansi. And that talks really in some detail. Have you read that one yourself, Ian?
I haven't, but I'm familiar with the title.
Yeah, so that's a really excellent book. He's quite sympathetic to the Soviets in lots of ways, which I think helps him sidestep some of the traps that you might otherwise fall into. I mentioned earlier that the bear that went over the mountain, the game, not the children's book, but the book by Lester Grau. Apologies if I've mispronounced his name, but you know it looks like Grau, the German word, so I'm going to say it like the German word. And I don't know if Boris Gromov's book has been translated into English yet. So he wrote, he was the commander of the army in the last years of the war. He wrote his memoir. It's in some of it is, I think, a little bit of self-aggrandizement, but there's a lot of fairly personal stuff in there that I think humanizes him in quite a nice way. His book's called Ograniченный контингент, so the limited contingent, but I don't think it's been translated yet. Maybe it will be in the future. As far as films go, the most successful film that's covered the war was Ninth Company, but that was almost universally disliked by veterans of the war. They felt that it was very unfair, that it just didn't give a realistic picture of what the war was like at all. But I think it's available free of charge on Mosfilm, and even with English subtitles, the film Afghan Breakdown, which was released in 1990, so still in the Soviet Union. It's about the essentially psychological impact of the war on a major in the Soviet army, which is and that film was praised largely by a lot of the veterans for really showing what it was like. It's not an easy watch. It doesn't have the production values of the later film. So Ninth Company was 2005, I think. You know, very much made in the mold of a Hollywood action film. But yeah, Afghan Breakdown is very very much as a 1990 Soviet film, but it is watchable. It's very hard hitting in lots of ways, but a really excellent film. You've also got the TV series Caravan Hunters, which is quite entertaining.
I mean, with the Vietnam War, there's a lot of songs that sort of originate from that, protest songs and what have you. Is there any similar sorts of types of music from the Afghan War?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can imagine Joanna Stingray jumping up and down to name them as well. The artist who is, I think, most associated with the Afghan War is a bard, they would call him Alexander Rosenbaum. He's still alive. He was not a rock musician and was therefore not considered subversive in Soviet times. Actually went out to perform for troops, and he sang a lot of songs about the grind and the experience of the troops on the ground. But the more hard hitting, the more critical songs. There's the Train on Fire, Poezd v Ognie, which is one of Karaim's songs written by Boris Grebenshikov. Brilliant song about just how the people have been lied to, and how actually all they want to do is all they should do is just go home, because there's nothing in this fight for them. Which is an influential song in the fall of the Soviet Union, and I think the headline song would be by Kino, so Viktor Tsoi's song Blood Group, Grupa Krovi, which is. If you haven't heard it, it really hits hard. And from the album of the same name, absolute classic of Russian popular music. I don't think there's any adult Russian speaker out there who doesn't know it.
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.